Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the old adage goes, one must never talk about money, religion, or politics in polite company. So don't fret, don't stammer. Here to help us is Chris Collin and Rob Bedeker, co-authors of What to Talk About. Here to spice up our conversational skills. They're joining us now from KQED in San Francisco. Chris and Rob, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I was wondering which one of you was going to talk first.
That's a big problem, isn't it, in conversation, especially when you have more than two people.
On the radio.
That, yeah, awkward stall. So you've got to come prepared to put a foot forward and to offer something.
Well, we believe in breaking the don't talk about money rule. We believe in breaking almost every rule because saying the right thing is too much pressure. Saying the wrong thing is often far more interesting, and that's the point of conversation. We're trying to be interesting and memorable. Life is short. You got to talk a little more boldly.
Almost every rule? Are there any things that are just taboo you won't even touch?
We're just going to wait and see if you do that, and then we'll let you know if you said something horribly offensive.
Well, let's make it clear. You are not scientists. You're not motivational speakers, but you're academics. So who's your audience for this book?
Our audience, well, at first it was ourselves, and then it sort of became everyone when we realized that a lot of people shared our problem. We found that we were sort of panicking all the time, really. I mean, we're relatively smart people, especially me. And yet, you know, you find yourself in an elevator or on the seat next to someone on a plane, and you sort of panic over what to say. Or you have a really close friendship or a romantic relationship. You've been together or been friends for many years, and your conversations are sort of middling.
Everywhere we go, people, when they hear about the book, say, I need that. And they're good talkers. I mean, we're doing fine, but there's about a 10% gap or 11% because we are actually scientists and inventors and motivational speakers and now authors. And people want to get better. They want to bridge the gap about 10% of the time to go further, make it more interesting, make it more fun.
So you guys are really good at filling in those awkward pauses with some conversation starters or cold openings, as you call them. My favorite might have been, I bet your spirit animal is an attic raccoon. Sure to get a...
Virginia, that's your spirit animal, isn't it?
How did you know?
There's something, I think, in the voice. We're very intuitive. And
being intuitive is part of being a good talker. You've got to relax. Sometimes you have to close your eyes in a conversation, tune into your instincts.
And you're very resourceful, obviously. We just met you. But an attic raccoon has figured some stuff out, how to find a warm house. You know, this is a compliment.
Well, thank you very much, because I'm not sure if I feel complimented. But what are some of the other kind of cold openings that you guys have come up with?
Well, often we need conversation in these sort of glancing exchanges with the person at the cash register in the checkout lane at the grocery store. You know, Rob, what would you say to that person when you don't just want to say, hi, how's it going?
I'd say those shoes are incredible. Where did you get them? I would say, you know, offer a dilemma to people. This gets the mind going in a different way. I would say if you had a third eye in the middle of your back and you were online dating, would you mention it in your profile or would you wait for the first date? It really lets people open up.
Yeah. Does anybody look at you when you say something like that to them and maybe think, I don't think I want to talk to this person?
If that happens, you're doing something right. No, but in all seriousness, you know, we think it's okay to sort of go into weird territory every now and then. You don't want to be totally weird and have no friends. But in our experience, people are open to all sorts of things, far more than we think when we walk into a conversation. People want to go into left field every now and then because, you know, deep inside, we're all weird.
People do say, though, that they dislike small talk. You know, it's superficial. It's party talk. But they seem to do plenty of it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, small talk is a great starting place. We don't dismiss small talk, but you got to make it bigger. You got to push further. So the classic small talk subject is the weather, right?
Right.
And how's the weather, it's cold, it's hot, pretty finite category. But push that into big talk by asking a weather-related question. For example, what's the coldest you've ever been? Or what's the worst sunburn you've ever had? You take the weather and you push it into the realm of story, and now we're getting somewhere.
I guess that's sort of like approaching a good interview. You know, you don't want to ask people a yes or no question. You want to make them tell a story.
Right. Yeah, curiosity is key, right? And also admitting your own ignorance. Too often we're worried about looking smart or letting on that we don't know something. But if you can put your heads together with somebody, ignorance is fun. In other words, you can explore the question of what is wind? What is thunder? Speaking of weather-related topics, I kind of know, but I'm not totally sure. And if I pair up with a good conversation partner, we can have fun exploring that.
What exactly was the Korean War about? Could I really describe the difference between a democracy and a republic? You know, if you sort of expose your ignorance, we find that that's a great way to connect with people, because then they can expose theirs, and then you can sort of bond over how stupid you are, and that's sort of a sweet feeling. It's poignant.
You're talking a little bit also about how we reflect each other, right? There's a segment in the book on mirroring, that our mm-hmm. responses to small questions actually matter. So tell us about this mirroring phenomenon.
Well, mirroring is repeating blandly the same words or idea of the person you're talking to. We do it all the time, right? So it's a beautiful day. Yeah, it's a beautiful day. And the conversation just drops a transmission, so to speak, and all of its tires go flat. Instead of mirroring, we suggest taking the conversation to an unexpected place. So instead of it's a beautiful day, it's a beautiful day, it's a beautiful day. Yeah. Do you ever think about the fact that ghosts don't visit the gym? They go to creepy old houses, but you never hear about someone's deceased grandmother on the Nautilus machine. Why is that?
There's also a lot of mirroring that happens just in the most common conversation starter and killer, which is, hi, how's it going? And we mirror by even indulging that question, fine, it's going fine. And Rob and I are big advocates of answering the question that you wish had been asked. How's it going? You know, I've been thinking about the Chuckwalla lizard, which is a real lizard that can live without water. And pretty soon you're talking about what it means to live without water, how the scientists even learned this, and you can start talking about something more interesting than how's it going.
I'm speaking with Chris Collin and Rob Bedeker. They are co-authors of the book What to Talk About. This is for on a plane or at a cocktail party or in a tiny elevator with your boss's boss. What kind of things do you say? Okay, so you guys are talking about a lot of interpersonal stuff, but how about a party? Now, this is the sort of the nadir for people who are fearful of coming up with the right conversation. How do you prepare?
Well, one thing we recommend is preparing. You know, I think people are a little allergic to the idea of coming to a social situation with some kind of canned answer. You might seem like a phony or something.
But preparing, you mean like, you know, sort of in the bathroom mirror before you go, preparing some small talk?
Any mirror, bathroom, bedroom, car mirror.
They make tiny mirrors now you can actually carry around in your pocket.
But anyways, no, we mean, you know, having something ready to go in case your mind goes white and you absolutely can't summon a thought. And then it's fine to say, hey, you know, this reminds me of something I've been thinking about.
You use the word nadir, Virginia, which is a great word. And if I had nothing else to talk about right now, I might ask you about that word, which is an example of what we call a trigger word, pulling something out of the other person's sentence and being curious about it or taking it in a new direction.
Well, I wondered if I should have said nadir, actually.
I wondered, too. You know, that's something to talk about. How confident were you when you said nadir? You know, I think we all sort of wonder about these kinds of things all the time. Did I say it wrong? Oh, my God.
But I just took that risk. I guess I feel like I can talk with you guys.
The possibilities are proliferating here because you made an offer, what we call an offer. You took a little bit of a risk, and we were not afraid to expose our ignorance, and now we're talking.
Well, all right, I'm going to set the scene here. We're at a party, or you're at a party. You don't know that many people. Everybody seems to be insulated in impenetrable conversations. They're talking about nadirs or nadirs and fascinating things like that. So how do you break in?
Well, one thing that you can do is play a game. People like games. We're all children inside. Walk into a circle and say, okay, I'm just going to introduce myself. My name is so-and-so. Who would each of you be if you had to be cast in a movie? You know, who do we think we are? Are you the nabbishy accountant? Are you the sarcastic, wisecracking friend? Are you the swashbuckling hero? And pretty soon you're not, you know, it's a safe topic. Everyone knows about movies. It's funny. But you're sort of introducing yourselves.
I also like the game that you've got in here called the Versus game. So you can start a sort of debate with pie versus cake or Kramer versus Kramer.
Yeah, everybody says Kramer. Everybody's got an opinion. That's one of the generous moves you can make is to ask people for their opinion. The Versus game is a perfect way to do that. Everybody has an opinion about pie versus cake, and they've got a story about why they prefer one or the other.
Another thing to remember in a party situation is even if you just do horribly and you just everything goes south and you just say something stupid or you just stand there blinking awkwardly for a minute, we believe in the pay it forward model here at What to Talk About. You have just given these people something to talk about with the next person. They can talk about how disastrous this last conversation was.
And let's face it, it's pretty easy to move between states these days. You can pack up and get out of there if it really goes bad.
All right. So you mentioned the passing exchange with the grocery checker. What are some other ideas for a passing exchange? I mean, a lot of people, they just don't know what to say when they get in a taxi cab. They don't know what to say to the receptionist. These things come up for people quite a bit.
Taxi cab's a great one. I think part of the stress there is you sense that there's a lot to talk about. This is a person who probably leads a very different existence than you, and you want to get in there and hear those stories. It's hard to get them going. You don't know if the person wants to talk. You know, again, we believe in being bold. I bet you've heard some interesting stories. I bet you've had some interesting fares. You know, one thing we advise against is saying, what's the most interesting ride you've ever given? Superlatives actually shut people down. They get paralyzed trying to figure out what was the most interesting thing. Better just to say, what was an interesting thing that happened?
I like some of the other suggestions for the taxi driver. What's the craziest non-sexual thing that's happened in this cab? What are you running from emotionally?
You got to feel it out first.
Yeah. Okay, you've also got shaking it up with our UPS delivery person, plumbers, and handy suggestions for note cards with dentists. I'm hoping that you've tested all of these things out. And the reactions, what, generally good? Do people shut down? Do they open up?
Yeah, we tested them rigorously. Rob and I each went to the dentist about twice a week for several months. It was painful, but we were willing to do that. It works. People are game for anything. That was our big takeaway. People are really up for talking about much more than you would think.
They're so refreshed to see something different.
Are there benefits of this beyond just, you know, having a two-way conversation? How do we reward being a great conversationalist?
Fame, money, relationships, experience, and
food.
Food. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, all the big moments in our lives, or most of them, involve some kind of talking. There's the job interview. There's the first date. There are the random encounters that turn out to form lasting bonds. They start with talking, and sometimes with small talk.
Facebook and Twitter are often dismissed as party conversation, as superficial conversation. Is the nature of conversation changing since we have Facebook and Twitter? Because, you know, there are a lot of provocative things that are put out in social media.
I think that they are great. They're wonderful. Anytime you're having a nice time and sharing pictures of your kids, that's great. But I also think it's good to be mindful of the ways that they are sucking the thoughts out of our heads, even when we're not aware. I mean, think about the last time you were waiting for your hot dog to finish microwaving. What did you do? You took the phone out of your pocket and you Instagrammed. It used to be that we would have thoughts pop into our head and the well of ideas would gradually replenish. And now we worry that that's not happening as much as it should.
On the other hand, you can hone your language, especially on Twitter, where brevity is a necessity. It allows you to sharpen your thoughts and you can recycle those in the real world.
Well, good to know. Thank you for that helpful tip and all the rest, Chris and Rob.
Thank you, Virginia.
Thanks, Virginia.
Chris Collin and Rob Bedecker. They are co-authors of What to Talk About on a Plane, at a Cocktail Party, in a Tiny Elevator with Your Boss's Boss, all sorts of different situations. And if you'd like to be further convinced, you can watch a brilliant little book trailer for them. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org.
Don't you hate that?
Hate what?
Uncomfortable silences. Why do we feel it's necessary to yak about in order to be comfortable?
I don't know. That's a good question.
We're going to continue our look into the art of the chat with a different type of conversation, one that can be accomplished without making a sound. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We just learned a few novel tricks for starting conversations. Let's turn now to discussions conducted without making a sound, using sign language, where eye contact is key. This story comes to us from Roman Mars and 99% Invisible.
Do you mind if I talk to you while we walk?
If you've ever seen an episode of the TV show The West Wing, you probably know one of its trademark scenes. The walk and talk.
You're going to this meeting?
Yeah.
WW160, you've been able to find it?
I don't even know where I am right now.
I'm looking on this side again. Do you mind if I talk to you while we walk?
But after you watch a few episodes, you might notice something. The characters almost never look at each other. They mostly look straight ahead. And there's a good reason for this. When people walk and talk, they don't need to look at each other. We use our eyes to navigate. We use our ears to listen.
But that doesn't work if you're deaf.
That's our reporter today, Tom Dreisbach. He went to Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. to talk to a researcher named Robert Servage.
Gallaudet is the only university in the world designed entirely for the deaf and hard of hearing. Robert is deaf himself, and he's been looking into this question of how deaf people walk and sign.
Robert Servage put cameras on the heads of different pairs of people, both hearing and deaf.
And he did this so he could precisely monitor what people look at when they walk and talk versus when they walk and sign. And he found very clear differences.
This is the voice of a Gallaudet translator speaking for Robert.
To hearing people look straight ahead the whole time they were walking, you might see just a few seconds, very rare seconds, when the person would look at the other person who they were walking beside and speaking. They wouldn't ever make eye contact. One would look at the other. While as with deaf people, there was that continuous maintained eye contact.
But maintaining eye contact also means you can't pay full attention to any obstacles up ahead.
And that's a problem if you're walking.
For walking and signing to work, the people holding a conversation need to keep an eye out for obstacles.
But it's not like deaf people make a deal at the beginning of a conversation. You talk, I'll be the lookout.
When deaf people are looking at one another, there's an agreement, an internal agreement, unspoken agreement that's understood between the two people conversing.
It's almost like the people, when you're in a conversation, you're in a kind of dance where you're not discussing what's happening between each other, but you just sort of know what the next move should be.
That's exactly it.
But when they're designing buildings, most hearing architects are not thinking about providing a venue for this dance.
That's actually also true of many buildings at Gallaudet University, even though it's dedicated to teaching the deaf and hard of hearing. But several years ago, the university realized that some of its standards of architecture and innovation had slipped.
So Gallaudet asked architect Hansel Baumann to help lead a group project called Deaf Space to collect ideas and rethink campus design with deaf people in mind.
The campus took those ideas and poured them into the design of a new building called the Sorensen Language and Communication Center, but everyone calls it the SLCC.
There are some obvious things like adding automatic sliding doors so conversations don't grind to a halt at every threshold.
And then there are more subtle changes. One of the big ideas behind Deaf Space is avoiding eye strain. That's because when you communicate all day with your eyes, it's easy to get tired.
So if you have bad lighting conditions, for example, which is backlighting, glare, high contrast between dark spaces and light spaces, all of those annoyances in and of themselves may not be so bad, but taken together over the time of a day, it's the beginning of eye strain. And eye strain really wears people out, basically.
And when we walked by a classroom, Hansel pointed inside at the color scheme.
The color of the blue classroom, that's a color we've been experimenting with, is a good contrast to a range of skin tones. You can just so clearly see sign language in there.
And for Hansel, working on Deaf Space has meant becoming sensitive to a range of issues that he had never thought of before.
The window that the deaf experience offers to architects is to provide us with a new kind of awareness around what's working and what's not working in a room that we might accept every day as just kind of our condition and we're not aware of it. It's not in front of us in a way that we can name what's the aggravation in the room or the environmental stressor. We don't have a way to recognize that, whereas I think it's part of everyday deaf experience.
That's Roman Mars, host and producer of the design and architecture podcast, 99% Invisible. In our digital universe, privacy settings are important, a little complicated, and frequently ignored. Up next, we're going to speak with a social media evangelist who has learned to stop worrying and love oversharing. First, the news from NHPR.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From revelations of NSA surveillance to the Heartbleed virus to the use of Google Glass in public spaces, personal privacy is one of the evolving quandaries of the digital age. While protecting our privacy is not always an option, we do have two choices when it comes to using social media. Quit or leave a self-revealing data trail. Christian Payne has chosen the latter in a big way. Originally a professional photographer, Christian's bread and butter was selling photographs to the UK dailies, which sent him to Iraq, Pakistan, and other newsworthy places. Then came the digital revolution, and with it, higher quality amateur cameras at a much cheaper price. While the prospects for professional photographers diminished, Christian Payne's took off. He joins us now to explain how. Christian Payne, great to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So how would you like to be identified? I mean, what's your title now?
I've got different titles depending on who wants to work with me.
Okay, well, say I want to have an interview with you.
I'm a blogger.
You're a blogger?
Yeah.
You used to be called a photographer, though. You worked in Iraq, among other places. When did that shift?
When I realized that there was this perpetual wave of disruption hitting pretty much every industry, and if I didn't evolve into at least doing multimedia, for example, taking audio and putting those with photos, meant that I could create really interesting multimedia stories. That put me kind of head and shoulders ahead of the photographers around me.
Right. I guess a lot of them were probably running scared because they're no longer getting paid, or people can get photographs online for free.
People are scared of their business model being threatened, and with photographers, it was as if every photograph had to be sold. Well, I made more money out of doing stuff off the back of sharing images. Every image I shared was a calling card for myself. For example, by putting my photographs online on Flickr or another photo sharing website, people were like, what are you doing? People are going to steal those. And I'm like, fine. The tools are here now for me to find those that have stolen the images. And I don't invoice them for usage if they're a newspaper. If they're a blogger and they've linked to me, fine. I use Creative Commons licensing quite a lot. If they're a newspaper and they've taken my image, I'll invoice them for theft and it's worth a lot more to me.
Now, wait, you've got this little, what is it called? You've got a narrative clip that you're wearing on your plaid shirt.
There's
what
a few different cameras around right now and I'm experimenting with this one. This is one of the many wearable technology devices that are out there. And this enables you to take photographs without thinking about taking photographs. And there's a scary side to this, and there's actually quite a beautiful side to this. Every 30 seconds, this is taking an image. And I won't see that image until later on tonight when I plug this into my computer and it downloads and then uploads. And then I can see those images on my phone. This isn't for the images I want to take. This is for the moments of the day that I would love to have taken an image. And I'm kind of gifted an image by this device. It's very strange. I've only learned this recently. I didn't get it until I found a couple of beautiful images from moments in the day where I was doing something. And all of that moment came rushing back to me.
I'm not very good at math, but every 30 seconds, a lot of images in a given day.
It cleverly kind of curates the images, and it will say, this is the condensed version of images which we think have nice photos in and faces. And if you click a button, it will show you the 100, 200, 300 images. I don't have it on all day. If I take it off right now and put it face down on the table, it switches off.
Mm-hmm. I looked up the narrative clip, right? And the tagline is, remember every moment. And I wonder, should we remember every moment, Christian? I mean, what does continuous documentation add to or even detract from an experience?
Of course, there's a danger in us archiving absolutely everything and then sticking it on servers which we now know all too well are not secure.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to do this responsibly. I'm not asking for permission for anybody as I walk around with this. When I accidentally forget to take it off going through customs, I'm breaking a law.
Hmm.
These are some of the instances that I want to be aware of, because this for me is an experimentation right now. I am not your normal kind of user of this, because I want to document the world around me. I want to understand how my behavior is changing and those around me, because we are entering quite an exciting new time. This kind of device is no different to the Google Glass, which everybody
right.
is excited or freaked out about. And in a few years' time, we'll be having contact lenses that will do the same.
Mm-hmm. In a way, you know, we go through a world where we are being monitored quite a bit, and suddenly you're turning the table and kind of monitoring the world.
There's something called surveillance, watching the watchers. And for a while now, every year I'll get together with a group of friends at George Orwell's grave in Sutton Courtney in Oxfordshire, and we will talk about civil liberties, and we'll talk about what privacy means today. This year was very exciting with a lot of the Snowden revelations. And for many times now, we will share images of CCTV and surveillance devices as people capturing and witnessing, saying, we know you're there, we can see you watching, just to let you know that we know. Because we do switch off to this.
So when you share those images, what is your kind of goal in putting those images on display for other people to see?
There's a side effect to sharing anything online. For me, when you share multimedia in online spaces, I aim and I hope that some of those will trigger thoughts the same way an artist might do it. I would never call myself an artist. But ultimately, the conversations I have from the small things that occur on the internet can lead to huge revelations, great new network connections. So for me, there is a value in sharing, and you never quite know what it's going to be, you know. What is the return on investment of me being in social media? I hear all the time, and I'll say, what's the return on investment of that conversation you had down the pub where you learned something you couldn't have learned anywhere else?
Yeah, but you're pointing to something that it was a mystery to me reading about this clip, that conversation that you're having down at the pub becomes a moment in time, becomes something etched in your own memory. Does it become something else if you then go through the photographs of it and see it, you know, as captured by the camera on your chest?
Memories are never the truth of what's happened, because we remember them through filters anyway. If you go and revisit places from your childhood, I guarantee they're going to be different to how you have remembered them, because there is a distortion field the moment we try to remember anything. If nothing else, looking at a photograph taken in that time, when we get the ability, because at the moment we don't, to trawl through tens of thousands of images to bring out those moments, you'll suddenly realise that, wow, the door was on the left of that window, not on the right. How weird my mind is.
We're speaking with Christian Payne. He's a blogger. He's on Twitter at Documentally, where you can see some of his work. So a lot of people who are concerned about the privacy of their data, there's an urge to contract. There's an urge to not share data or just be a lot more careful about it. Others are proposing that we should level the playing field. We should try and own that data and use it for our own means. How do we manage that wish to share and understand and the other wish to protect?
You can control your data flow, and you can learn about how to share sensibly or ethically. You can't control the way people feel about what you are sharing, but in my case, I believe sharing curated content that I want to be out there does create my kind of image of how people think of me. And yes, it's very similar to the actual person I am. back. So I almost give up things as I let go of them, because as much as I would love to control the data that is captured and taken from my feeds and used to sell things back to me, it's pretty fruitless, really, let's face it. I mean, we sign up to these free, in inverted commas, social media sites when we know they're not free at all. We are ultimately the product which is being sold to others, and then we are being sold back to.
I had a conversation with Sherry Turkle. Do you know who she is? She's at MIT. She was a very early proponent of internet culture, I guess, in the late 90s and early 2000s. And she wrote a book called Alone Together. One of the things that really stuck with me is she said that we are creating devices now that give us the illusion of companionship without the demands of friendship. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that as somebody who functions and connects with so many different people in this social media space.
I think the same arguments and discussion came about when the telephone came about. For me, when I speak to my grandmother on the phone, who doesn't really use any social media apart from her Twitter account when I'm sat with her.
What's her handle?
Granumentally. So when I spoke to my grandmother on the telephone, she wasn't in an alternate reality or in a separate place. The phone was just between me and her. I wasn't getting her body language. I wasn't getting anything other than her intonation, the sound of her voice. That was enough for me to know it was my grandmother and still feel the same love. Yes, if you are only ever speaking to people in 140 characters of text, you are going to miss out on a relationship, the same as if you use an email or anything else. I, working from my shed in a small village in England, meet more people in, whether you want to call it meet space or away from keyboard, than I ever would do if I wasn't plugged into these networks. Mm. So for me, there is no tool more social that actually gets me into the same room as other people.
You were speaking all last week to students at SNHU about social media, about connection, probably about advice to where they are going or what you would recommend. Want to share any of those with us?
I would have been terrified way back, because back when I was at school, you knew exactly what you were going to do, and that might well be a job for life. Things are so different now. The importance is in being agile. It's in having more than one revenue stream, potentially, more than one skill set. For my personal story, I talk, I teach, and I document. If I didn't have those three strings to my bow, I don't think I'd be able to earn a living. And being agile and being able to switch between those or replace them when need be hopefully makes me sustainable and future-proof. That's what people need to be thinking about now. I couldn't do any of that without a network of people. I recommended they start right now and they follow people smarter, better, faster, quicker, and more connected to themselves. We're not working alone anymore. We're not eating alone anymore. We're not walking alone anymore. When you have access to thousands of people, potentially millions, through a device that sits in your back pocket.
Christian Payne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can join the tens of thousands of followers of Christian Payne at Documentally on Twitter. We have a link to that and more on the narrative clip camera. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. For a social media fanboy like Christian Payne, there is always a new platform for sharing and connecting with others. Just as AOL made way for Gmail and MySpace made way for Facebook. But what happens to the old profiles we leave behind? Producer Taylor Quimby found out.
MySpace. One could say it's the velvet leisure suit of social media.
Do you have a MySpace account?
MySpace, yes, actually do.
Do you use it on a regular basis?
I haven't touched it in years, to be honest.
But it's probably still there.
Yes.
It's pretty normal to look back at old outfits and wonder, what was I thinking? History hasn't been kind to hammer pants or the fanny pack. And like the leisure suit, MySpace has suffered the same sort of fate. It's become a punchline.
Do you know anybody that has a MySpace?
Yeah, my dad has a MySpace.
But lest we forget, we're not talking about a trend from 15 or 20 years ago. In fact, it wasn't until 2008 that Facebook users first outnumbered fans of MySpace. Less than 6 years ago. MySpace was the hottest social media platform since Friendster. Remember Friendster? And even today, MySpace claims to have some 36 million users. But who are they? Do you have one? Did you ever have one? And when you decided to move on, did you delete your account?
All right. Let's see if we can find Taylor's MySpace.
Taylor?
That's producer Zach Nugent and my boss, Maureen McMurray.
MySpace.
So, if you haven't already guessed, there's a reason I'm the one telling the story.
Okay, here it is. Oh, my.
That's Taylor. Yeah. That's oh, what... my God. What is going on here? Let's just... Is that Taylor?
Around 2006 and 7, I was really into MySpace. And then, like many others, I abandoned it. I didn't delete my account, I just kind of drifted away. And since nobody I knew used it anymore, I sort of thought MySpace would just drift away too. But in 2012 and 2013, MySpace redesigned the site to focus on the one demographic still using it, musicians. They ditched the classic MySpace look, and all the blog posts, messages, likes and dislikes we agonized over, it all got sent to the digital trash bin. All of it except for one thing, the photos. Which means if you haven't deleted your account, its ghost is still there, and your leftover MySpace photos are up for the whole world to see.
Taylor, did you ever have a shaved head?
Shaved head with ping pong balls as eyes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's you?
Brushing your teeth?
In the MySpace days, I looked a lot different.
And there's one of him.
As like the Joker?
Do you have blood on your face?
Frankly, I didn't use a lot of discretion when posting pictures.
Do we want to just describe this photo?
He's pantsless and he has an axe.
He's in a Speedo. He's in a straight-up Speedo.
My MySpace page was an extension of my musical alter ego at the time, an experimental project I called Milky Pink.
Like this, it looks like you're part of some cult.
It was pretty weird.
I don't know if you can read the caption underneath, but it says Milky Pink, murder capital of the world.
That was, okay, so the explanation here is that was the cover art for my first album as Milky Pink.
That's it?
Yeah.
And that's you?
Yep. Now, none of this stuff is so bad it would ever get me fired, I think. But should I ever be looking for a new job, it's within the realm of possibility that an employer might see it. And the fact that it's just sitting out there for anybody with an internet connection to see makes me pretty uncomfortable. And work aside, I'm a dad now. I don't plan on hiding my past from my son, but I would like to be able to control how it's presented. So, here it is. The point of this whole story, how to delete your MySpace profile. Step 1. If you know the email and password to your old account, then congratulations, this is going to be a snap. All you have to do is log back in, go to your settings, and select Delete Account. If, like me, though, you don't have a clue what your email address was when you signed up for MySpace, or you signed up with a college email that's since been deactivated, it's a little more complicated. Before you can delete an account, you've got to prove that it's yours to delete. You need to sign the MySpace Declaration of Ownership. It's pretty easy to find once you know what you're looking for. To make it even easier, we've got a link at wordofmouthradio.org. But there is one tricky part. It requires that you attach a digital copy of a government-issued ID. Seriously. Once you've got that done, you can pretty much just fill it out and press send.
All right, I'm doing it, guys.
Let me see.
Oh, wait. It's mad at me. What did I fill out here?
The form is going to ask you for all the information we have already established you do not have access to. So you've got to find a workaround, like I did.
Okay, maybe if I just fill out don't know for all those fields.
Yeah.
Yeah, hold on.
Okay, now you can press send. And from there, you're just waiting. For me, it wasn't very long. I actually got an email from MySpace the very next day.
Already?
Yeah, I know. Let's see what it says. Thank you for filling out the deletion form. I have scheduled the profile in question for removal. So I guess that was it. Please allow up to 72 hours. Dexter.
This is sincerely Dexter.
MySpace, more efficient than we thought. My guess, Zach, is that like 90% of the staff is dedicated to deleting people's accounts at this point.
As it turns out, deleting your profile may not be the eye-rolling ordeal you'd imagine. And depending on what you find still there, if you happen to Google yourself, it could be a tremendous relief. So if you never deleted your old account, it might be time to do a little digital housekeeping. After all, there's really no such thing as MySpace or your space when it comes to the internet. It's everybody's space, for better and for worse. For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
Now, while you may not be able to find Taylor's MySpace page anymore, you will find a link to the MySpace Declaration of Ownership form and more on how to delete your account. All that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us as we continue our week-long series on Poetry Out Loud. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. April is National Poetry Month, and all this week we are presenting recitations from some of New Hampshire's bright young high school students. All of them were finalists in the Poetry Out Loud competition held last month. It is by far one of my favorite annual events, watching young people pour their passion and theatricality into poems in front of a crowd at the New Hampshire State House's Representatives Hall. Here's the next poem in our series.
My name is Frenson Pakpahun. I am in 10th grade. I am a sophomore at Dover High School. My poem is titled The Gift by Lee Young Lee. To pull the metal splinter from my palm, my father recited a story in a low voice. I watched his lovely face and not the blade. Before the story ended, he'd removed the iron sliver I thought I'd die from. I can't remember the tale, but hear his voice still, a well of dark water, a prayer. And I recall his hands, two measures of tenderness he laid against my face. The flames of discipline he raised above my head. Had you entered that afternoon, you would have thought you saw a man planting something in a boy's palm, a silver tear, a tiny flame. Had you followed that boy, you would have arrived here, where I bend over my wife's right hand. Look how I shave her thumbnail down so carefully. She feels no pain. Watch as I lift the splinter out. I was 7 when my father took my hand like this, and I did not hold that shard between my fingers and think, metal that will bury me. Christen it Little Assassin, or Going Deep for My Heart. And I did not lift up my wound and cry, death visited here. I did what a child does when he's given something to keep. I kissed my father.
Frenson Pakpahun there, a 10th grader at Dover High School, who, by the way, brought his own father and family with him to the NHPR studios for the taping. You can see photographs of all of the students reciting their poems and also find a link to videos from the Poetry Out Loud competition, all at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd like you to help us celebrate National Poetry Month, but don't worry, you won't have to memorize Whitman, Dickinson, or Yeats. We'd like you to share your public radio-inspired haikus with us. Here's one example. I can't spell your name, but I know your voice so well. Oh, great Kai Ristall. A reminder, haiku consists of three lines. The first line, 5 syllables. Second line, 7. And the third line, 5 syllables. Please share your haiku on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, or on Twitter @wordofmouth. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.